Welcome to the London Walks podcast, presented by Andy Hallett and Adam Scott Goulding.
So it's a Tuesday evening, and I'm doing the pub walk, the hidden pubs of old London, and we've just arrived from the Inns of Court at the Edgar Wallace. And I'm here with a fabulous cast of walkers, and we are talking and reading poetry. Yep, I say cast because these wonderful walkers, all our walkers are known for their generosity of spirit, have agreed very kindly to be reading all the parts in this poetry podcast. It's no coincidence, of course, that we're in the Edgar Wallace, because this is where the great poet and balladeer, the Bard of Dundee, Scotland's other national poet, performed the inspired poem, A Christmas Carol.
Therefore, good people, be warned in time, and in Christmas morn, don't get drunk in wine, but praise God above on Christmas morn, who sent his son to save us from hell and scorn.
Gratefully received by the publican, William McGonagall might follow up with the demon drink and a strict instruction to perform only at closing time, never before.
Therefore, brother and sisters, pause and think, and try to abolish the foul fiend drink. Let such a doctrine be taught in church and school, that the abolition of strong drink is the only home rule.
It would clear the pub, naturally. Yes, McGonagall, often cited as the worst poet in British history, a man so giftedly bad he backed unwittingly into genius, was first struck by the muse later in his life at the age of 42 in the year 1877. He said he felt a
strange kind of feeling stealing over him, which remained for so about 5 minutes. A flame, as Lord Byron said, seemed to kindle up his entire frame, along with a strong desire to write poetry.
It was then he was compelled to write his first poem, an address to the Reverend George Gillingham. A friend remarked,
"Shakespeare never wrote anything like this."
The former handweaver's poetical shortcomings would have undoubtedly generated dull and uninspiring verse in the hands of a lesser artist. And yet, weak vocabulary, ill-advised imagery and inappropriate rhythms in his combined to make some of the most unintentionally amusing poetry in the English language. Take, for example, the final verse of his most famous ditty, The Tay Bridge Disaster.
O ill-fated bridge of the silvery Tay, I must now conclude my lay by telling the world fearlessly and without the least dismay that your central girders would not have given way. Had they been supported on each side with buttresses, for the stronger we our houses do build, the less chance we have of being killed.
In 1877, following an inquiry as to the Queen's patronage, he received a polite rejection letter from a royal functionary. Emboldened, and hoping to enhance his reputation, he made the momentous decision to walk from Dundee to Balmoral, 60 miles through mountainous terrain and a violent storm, despite being
wet to the skin.
He hoped to perform to Her Majesty. He was, however, turfed off the grounds and told by the doorman, in no uncertain terms, Her Majesty already had a poet laureate, Alfred Tennyson. Indefatigable, McGonagall travelled to London and later New York, returning on both occasions more destitute and unsuccessful than before, but still undeterred. Here a simple stanza on his frustrations he felt after visiting London.
O mighty city of London, you are wonderful to behold, but your treatment towards strangers I think is rather cold. But you are very kind to them, while they have plenty of gold.
He did find some paid work in New York. Grief-stricken and deluded parents asked him to compose 4 sacred lines to commemorate the death of their departed little daughter.
Here lies little Mary Jane. She neither cries nor hollers. She lived but 1 and 20 days and cost us $40.
Small comfort. Newly appointed via a hoax letter, from now on he would refer to himself in publicity as Sir William Topaz McGonagall, Knight of the White Elephant of Burma. His notoriety as a self-styled tragedian and poet began to grow as he toured across the country in theatres, musicals and public houses. He would read his poetry amidst roars of laughter and derisive cheers unflinchingly, his lines invariably couched in godly words.
And if you are not a believer, try and believe and don't let the devil any longer you deceive.
His riposte to a critic who had criticised the length of his hair was typical.
And in conclusion, I'd have him to be aware and never again to interfere with a poet's hair, because Christ the Saviour wore long hair and many more good men, I do declare.
So more lucrative employment was eventually found, but only in a local circus in Dundee, where he was routinely pelted with stale bread, frozen peas and fresh herring, not the least deterred by the arrangement. He did, however, remain in dire financial straits. Later in life, sick and penniless, he wrote,
"Pity the sorrows for the poor poet when he wants bread. Help him living, for he requires no help when dead."
William McGonagall died destitute in 1902, buried in an unmarked grave in Edinburgh. Though clearly deaf to poetic metaphor, his execrable rhymes and terrible scansion have since assured him a very special place in the poetic pantheon, inspiring the likes of Spike Milligan, Monty Python, Terry Pratchett, Billy Connolly and J.K. Rowling. Minerva McGonagall is the sister of William. Of course, the question as to whether he was quite mad, a gullible fool, or really a very shrewd rogue with great music hall comic skills is still open to debate, but his determination, his self-belief and delusion, in opposition to almost unanimous negative critical opinion, is celebrated across the world. No better than on McGonagall Nights, where courses are naturally consumed in reverse, pudding first. So I'm at the final part of my Hidden Pubs walk, and we're finishing at the eastern end of Fleet Street, near the Punch Tavern. And if you look over the road, from left to right, you can see the New Farringdon Road, the far sides of which, and it's very, very wide, make up the banks of the River Fleet. If you ever look at an old drawing of the City of London, you think, you know, what is that to the left? What's that big river? Well, that's the River Fleet. And you can immediately understand why the Romans built the city where they did. The Thames to the south, marshy land to the north and the east, and there's the natural defence of the River Fleet to the west. The River Fleet begins its descent from Hampstead all the way down to Blackfriars, so it goes south, and even today its subterranean passage can be heard. We can hear it through grating outside the Coach and Horses pub, which is in Ray Street, Clerkenwell, and then again you can hear it through a grid in the centre of Charterhouse Street, where it joins the Farringdon Road. That's on the Smithfield side of the junction. Until the early 18th century, you could sail down this river, but by the mid-18th century, it was a kind of filthy, stinking ditch. And by the 19th, though most of the river had been enclosed or developed over, parts were still exposed. In fact, Dickens sets Fagin's Den in Oliver Twist over the Fleet Ditch in Saffron Hill, Clerkenwell. The river was the subject of a brilliant poem, which is written by Ben Jonson. It's called On the Famous Voyage. And the poem provides a mock epic account of a journey along the excrement-lined ditch during the early 17th century. The filth of the river is used as a metaphor to address anxieties that London had become a new Sodom, a monstrous body where sin was a fashion. This is just a small part of it.
"To this dire passage say thou stop thy nose. 'Tis but light pains. Indeed this dock's no rose. In the first jaws appeared that ugly monster, yclepid mud, which when their oars did once stir, belched forth an air as hot as the muster. Of all your night tubs when the carts do cluster, who shall discharge first his murred urinous load? Thorough her womb they make their famous road, between two walls, where on one side, to scar men, were seen your ugly centaurs ye call carmen, Gorgonian scolds and harpies. On the other hung stench, diseases, and old filth. Their mother, with famine, wants and sorrows, many a dozen, the least of which was to the plague a cousin."
It's a long poem, typical of Jonson. Prickly, wordy, angry, satirical, classically educated, self-conscious, well-read, technically brilliant. Jonson was a friend and rival of Shakespeare, but gracious enough to make a dedication to him in the first folio. He made, well, I think you can imagine him making hard work of his writing, and he seemed to lack the natural flow that for me characterises Shakespeare's work, but he was brilliant, uncompromising, Renaissance man, and judging by his portrait, he was large in frame and larger still in character. Ex-soldier, ex-bricklayer, then classically educated at Westminster. He killed a fellow actor in a duel in 1598, only escaping the gallows by claiming benefit of clergy, which is a kind of a legal ploy through which he could gain leniency by reciting a brief Bible verse called the neck verse. Nonetheless, he was branded with a T for Tyburn on his left thumb. Next time, he wouldn't be so lucky. Unlike Shakespeare, Jonson set much of his work in London. His brilliant city comedies, such as the scandalous Eastwood Ho, for which he was imprisoned again, or Bartholomew Fair, with his opening metadrama, are as much a gift to social historians as to the literary world. He also wrote masques and revels for the court, and it was rewarded with an annual pension, leading some to identify him as the first poet laureate. In 1618, he set off on foot to his ancestral home in Scotland and enjoyed the hospitality of the poet William Drummond. The conversations that were recorded are gossipy and opinionated. He was seen as a towering literary figure in his time and published his works in 1616, which may well have inspired Shakespeare's friends and colleagues to go ahead and publish the first folio in 1623. If ever an argument, I think, is put forward that Shakespeare was some kind of stooge, you can bet if Jonson had even a whiff of it, we would know about it. So I'm back here in the Blackfriars pub, and another poet draws to mind. His name is John Taylor, the water poet. I sometimes talk about him in my Along the Thames Walk, but like Jonson, he too journeyed to Scotland, though his most notorious and eccentric journey was his voyage. They were all the kind of fashion of the time, making these celebratory journeys. But he attempted to sail from London Bridge to Queensborough in a paper boat, with two stockfish tied to canes for paddles and oars. Inevitably, the boat sank, as it did when it was reenacted in 2006. Now, Taylor spent much of his life as a Thames waterman, ferry people between Bankside and the city. He was as much a rough and caustic wit as a poet, but the pamphlets he produced by subscription, some of it chiding his readers who hadn't yet paid up, humorously covered disputes between his guild and the authorities, the most interesting of which, the true cause of the waterman's suit concerning players, an issue that had been taken up with the players over the subsequent loss of revenue to the ferrymen when the playing companies had closed theatres on the south side. He gives one of the first and contemporary mentions of Shakespeare in his poem In Praise of Hempseed.
In paper many a poet now survives, or else their lines had perished with their lives. Old Chaucer, Gower, and Sir Thomas More, Sir Philip Sidney, who the laurel wore, Spenser and Shakespeare did art and excel, Sir Edward Dyer, Green, Nash, Daniel, Sylvester, Beaumont, Sir John Harrington. Forgetfulness their works would overrun, but that in paper they immortally do live in spite of death and cannot die.
He has also been credited with the first use of a palindrome. In 1614, he wrote, "Lewd did I live, and evil I did dwell." Now, if I were to travel north and get on the Bakerloo line and go to Maida Vale, it's the former home of the great poets, Byron and Robert Browning, both of whom have been credited with coining the phrase Little Venice. Sometimes I recite the famous poem by John Masefield, who lived here. He was the poet laureate from 1930 until his death in 1967. His famous poem, Sea Fever, evocative of returning to the high seas.
I must go down to the seas again to only see in the sky, and all I ask is a tall ship and a star to steer her by.
Made even more popular by Spike Milligan, who wrote,
I must go down to the seas again, to the lonely sea in the dark sky. I left my shoes and socks there, I wonder if they're dry.
My final poem is on the South Kensington Walk. It features my favourite poet, the Irishman Seamus Heaney, who only recently died. He was asked to sum up his lifetime achievements in poetry by choosing two poems, which is a pretty tall order. He chose his lyrical evocation of a moment during his own honeymoon, The Underground.
There we were in the vaulted tunnel running, you in your going away coat speeding ahead, and me then like a feet god gaining upon you before you turned to a reed, or some new white flower japped with crimson as the coat flapped wild and button after button sprang off and fell in a trail between the Underground and the Albert Hall. Honeymooning, moonlighting, late for the proms, our echoes die in that corridor, and now I come as Hansel came on the moonlit stones, retracing the path back, lifting the buttons, to end up in a draughty, lamplit station after the trains have gone, the wet track bared and tensed as I am, all attention for your step following, and damned if I look back.
The
London Walks podcast was compiled, produced and presented by Andy Hallett and Adam Scott Goulding. For details of the full programme of London Walks, London's best guided walking tours, go to www.walks.com. The London Walks podcast was an APB production.